the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome back to the CBP Friday Rip interview show, or Wednesday Rip, I should say. Man, we have too many shows, too many days. I'm getting confused on the day of the week here. My name is Joey. I have a very, very fun guest today, Hrvoje Morić from the Geopolitics and Empire show. I think you guys are really going to like some of the stuff he has to say. We've talked about his show on the CBP before. I listen to his show quite frequently. It helps inform some of the things we talk about on CBP from sort of the global perspective. As you guys know, we do the Clown World segment every week. It gets longer and longer. I think it started out like a half an hour kind of finisher to the Bitcoin show. And now it's, as you guys know, its own episode. So there's lots to talk about. And Hrvoje is going to help us parse some of the stuff that's going on. But first, two great sponsors of this program. One is EasyDNS. You guys know Mark. You love Mark. If you need a domain name, if you need registrar services, if you need a website, you know, if you want to build a website like we've done with CanadianBitcoiners.com and you want to start whatever your it is and you need a website for your it, Mark and team will help you out. Whether it's registrar services, domain services, virtual private server stuff, they're obviously doing a lot of stuff with Noster relays, Bitcoin nodes, nodeless implementations, BTC pay servers. If you want to get out of this system that, as we've seen in the last couple of days in Canada, you know, can move against you on a whim, not necessarily legally. This is the kind of stuff you have to start thinking about. And Mark and team at EasyDNS can help you with that. And of course, you know, I have Mark's book, Unassailable. I think it's right behind me here. Yeah. So you never have to worry about being taken down over at EasyDNS. He's willing to stand up for you and make sure that your stuff is on solid ground. So head over, CBP Media is the code, or tell him he sent you. He's in the chat all the time. He's on Twitter. You guys know where to find him. And then the second sponsor is Bull Bitcoin. Bull Bitcoin is the best place for you to buy and sell, if that's your thing, Bitcoin in Canada. Obviously, you know, they have the bill service. You can pay all your bills there. You can send e-transfers. The spread is very, very low. You lock in your fee whenever you, or your price, I should say, whenever you do your buy. They have the privacy services on the back end. So when you send, you get CoinJoin, all these other sort of support features that the guys at the team will help you with or on the team will help you with, whether it's moving your coins to a new wallet, setting up a cold card for the first time. All this stuff is important because Bull is non-custodial. They never hold your coins, and so they can never freeze your Bitcoin. Perfect. And then on top of that, of course, if you go to the post office, you buy KYC-free corn, man. You can't beat that. Go up to $1,000 every day. Get to know your local postman or your local Shoppers Drug Mart employee. Iwantbitcoin.ca is the code if you haven't been there yet. I'm sure you have by this point, so looking forward to seeing you guys continue to add to your stack. Let's bring on our guest, Hrvoje Morić. Geopolitics and Empire. Okay, so one, it's great to see you. Two, I said on the show the other day, I think it was on my show, or I might have actually said this to my wife when she was asking me who we had on this week. Geopolitics and Empire is the most regal, high quality name for a podcast I think I've ever heard. How did you come up with that name? I really, really like the name of that show.
Well, I went through a few names because I was flying by the seat of my pants. Yeah, I had no idea what I was doing. You know that classic meme from SpongeBob with the guy like burning himself? Like, I was a teacher and I'm like, I want to talk to smart people. There's no smart people around me. So I just started Skyping in guests in my classroom, and I threw up, it's still up there, the original YouTube channel, Dissident Thinker. And then I'm like, Dissident Thinker, I need something. And then I decided Guadalajara Geopolitics Institute. Because I studied in Geneva at the School of Diplomacy, and one of my favorite professors, he had the Geneva School of Geneva Geopolitics Institute. So I kind of like was copying him. And I like, that doesn't really roll off the tongue. You need like two words, right? And geopolitics and empire. And that kind of summarizes what I'm most interested in, right? Geopolitics is like the science of politics, like the science where you throw into the pot the study of the economy, technology, demographics, geography, right? The elites. And then you can kind of figure out what's happening in the world. And then empire is like synonym for globalism, right? World government, which is like the ultimate goal of everything. So, yeah.
I like that. Why don't you tell people a bit about your background, Hervoya? I get the feeling you're also like a recovering poli sci major. I know I took poli sci as a BA, and I have to say I enjoyed it. But looking back, much like you, I guess I'm a little upset about some of the content over that 4-year stretch. And so I'm curious, you know, what's your background educational wise? You mentioned it a bit there, and talk to me a bit about the way your thinking has evolved over the years, because I would guess that a lot of people who come through sort of post-secondary education, especially some of the more prestigious ones, there's not too many people who wind up doing shows like yours after that that background. So tell me a bit about that.
I had to unlearn everything pretty much. But with my podcast, I'm lucky where I get to straddle the line between having dissident guests and academics and mainstream folks. I think coming up, a former Kuwaiti ambassador on the show. So I like to, it is what it is. They are more politically correct, but still, former ambassador to Kuwait. And so, hey, why not? And so, I'm born in Chicago, so I'm American. My name literally means Croat, as in Croatian. I know Mark Jeftovich is a Serbian, I think, from his background, but and I'm also a Croatian citizen, who I kind of grew up between both countries. And I identify first as a Croatian. And so I studied history in Illinois and education. And once I, in the 2000s, I went down the rabbit hole learning about, Alex Jones, InfoWars, G. Edward Griffin, Federal Reserve, all that stuff, 9/11. And then I just decided to expatriate permanently from the American Empire. My ticket out was Peace Corps Mongolia. So I went off to live in the yurts in the Gobi Deserts. I was even intermediate in Mongol after 6 months. And then I did my master's in Geneva, international relations. And then I was looking, the world was my oyster. I was going to look for jobs in Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Alaska, anywhere. I just love going all over the place. And they hired me in Mexico at the Tecnológico de Monterrey, which turns out is it's a totally globalist institution. It's the top school in Mexico. It's a high school and university. All the millionaires send their kids there. It's the only school in all of America that attends Davos. They're officially linked to the Economic Forum. We've had Al Gore visit us on campus. Bill Gates and Hillary Clinton spoke at the online graduation speeches during the pandemic, and so. Taught there, and then I got a gig in Kazakhstan for 3 years until the pandemic hit. I was teaching at Nazarbayev's intellectual school. Somehow I met Gorbachev. I shook hands with Gorbachev. I went to Russia for a 3-week peace diplomacy thing and met people like Gorbachev. And then, I got my podcast and doing TNT Radio almost 2 years, TNT Radio.
TNT Radio is a lot of fun. I did an appearance on that. I really enjoyed our conversation. It's kind of it's a lot faster paced than the podcast world, I find. Some good, some bad about that, but it's always fun to be on the other side of the mic. I look forward to doing stuff like that. So let's talk a bit then about your interest, my interest, and the reason we wanted to bring you on. There's so much going on when it comes to this idea of empire at the moment. And I think for a lot of people, especially in the West, empire means basically one thing. It's US hegemony and sort of Western hegemony. I'm not convinced that the Western hegemony is long for this world. In the Bitcoin space, there's a lot of people who think the same way I do. I suspect the same way you do, that we're witnessing the decline of the empire. They've seen their best years. Those best years are, at this point, I think it's fair to say, far behind them. And the activity that the empire sort of participates in and propagates now is more akin to last attempts, desperate attempts to hold on to power and relevance more than it is to grow, expand, and propagate the empire overseas as it's been in the past. Do you share that view? Where are you on sort of the state of the US hegemon and maybe the Western cultural hegemon as well?
I'd agree with that. I mean, that's 20 years I've been looking at that. One of my first interviews was with American cultural historian Morris Berman, who wrote a trilogy on the decline of American empire. I had breakfast with him here in Mexico many years ago. I think he's still down here. I got his books right behind me. I've been interviewed Johan Galtung, who's in his 90s now. He famously predicted in 1980, he said in 1990, the Soviet Union would collapse, and did. And he's been predicting 2025, next year, as when the US empire will collapse. And he's the founder of Peace and Conflict Studies. And so that's been one of my main themes as an American myself. One thing I forgot to mention, I grew up in the U.S. thinking the U.S. is just like any nation state. I'm a Croatian of Croatia. I'm an American of America. It's like, then you, it dawns on you, like, it's a kind of a shock. Wait a minute, we're not a nation state, we're an empire. This empire, American empire, you know? So I would agree with you. There's all this talk of multipolarity and all this stuff, and there's a whole story there, but you can see it everywhere. You know, Antonio Guterres last week or a week or two ago at the UN or Davos, wherever it was, saying it's a multipolar world. I just look at the headlines every day. Neil Ferguson, the establishment's historian, I think he's out in the UK. You know, he's putting out weekly op-eds on Bloomberg saying Pax Americana is dead. you know, you see yesterday in the news, it says world's most ambitious trade route stalls in Middle East turmoil. In their contest with China for global influence, the U.S. and Europe have struggled to win support in the developing world. So I think that is happening. But the empire notes never go the way, right? Those in the behind the veil, they just kind of, they're like parasites. They shift to the next system, right? You had the British, you know, Holy Roman Empire, the British Empire, the American Empire, and how we're going to have, it's not like we're going to be living in a world without empire, I think.
I want to talk to you a bit about the differences between the American hegemon and what I think, you know, the Eurozone would maybe in the 90s have tried to say was the European hegemon. I mean, they made an attempt, I think, to kind of cut America off at the knees with the Euro and the European Union. I think that's largely failed. But I'm curious, you know, when you look back at the formation of that that region, do you think that there's warning signs in places like America, Canada, Mexico, or even in the BRICS nations that there's certain signposts or certain thresholds that have been crossed on the way to something similar for those regions? In Canada, we hear an awful lot that the United States is sort of our, you know, friendly big brother to the South. I don't share that opinion. I think Mexico is probably also a bigger economy, or at least a more important economy than ours at the moment. And when I look at the way that we've positioned ourselves in terms of currency weakness, failed energy policy, and other sort of, you know, mistakes that are akin to those two, unfortunately, I worry that we're heading down the same path as some of the smaller European nations that didn't end up having a say in their own sovereignty and eventually their own currency in the Eurozone. Do you see any signposts abroad that kind of give you a signal that there's more attempts at these kind of globalist, let's call them, regions and their formation, you know, yet again, as we move forward here through the 2020s?
I unfortunately, look, I'm looking at this stuff. I'm listening to what the politicians say. I don't see them relenting. You know, it's one thing that the plans might be going awry. They're having issues, setbacks, things are collapsing here or there, but they're not giving up. You know, I view the EU, again, the EU is an empire. You've got an academic called Wolfgang Strict, I think, who's come out and there have been some academic papers discussed how, you know, again, they trick us, like America. They make us think it's not an empire. I've interviewed the John Perkins, economic hitman, and, you know, they've after World War II, it's an invisible sort of use for unprecedented history, like this new system of empire, where you got Bretton Woods system, IMF, World Bank, where you take over countries by stealth that way through the media, we'll call it revolutions. And so they're not giving up. And I just wanted to mention that I view the EU as it's part of this Western Anglo-Saxon, you know, Cecil Rhodes bid for world empire of integration. You know, they write in their white papers a century ago that we wanted to create an Atlantic Union first as the road to world union, world government. So that would mean like integrating Europe and North America. And so that's kind of what they've been playing around with. And I think there, again, there's an academic study that says more than 50% of the financing for the EU project came from CIA and State Department. So in a way, EU is like a vassal of Washington, but kind of, as you mentioned, it's failing in many ways, but they keep going. And in North America, I've always said EU is the blueprint. It's the blueprint for technocratic totalitarian world government. So that's like the prototype they created in the lab. It's the EU, supranational. Look what they're doing now, getting rid of free speech, censorship. Like it's a dictatorship. And so they want to replicate that to the rest of the world. And now you see the EU through its foreign policy arm is working with countries in Latin America and Africa to help them recreate the EU supranational regional systems there. You know, and so in North America, and just look what I called last year. No one's like, I haven't heard anyone except myself pointing this out. My Mexican president, because I'm also a Mexican citizen, you know, I got three passports. Here's my Mexican passport. AMLO, he last year said, he literally said, let's copy the EU and integrate Canada, USA, and Mexico. He literally said, it's in the transcript. And he was talking to Biden and Lincoln about that. He even said, let's unify, create an entire American Union. But, and you know, a lot of this stuff goes back. It's fascinating. I got Thomas Jefferson poster right behind me. Thomas Jefferson, in a letter 200 years ago, said the same thing. So, you know, this gets into like Freemasonry, the cult stuff. Like, it's mind-boggling. Like, there was a letter where Thomas Jefferson said, we should create and then, you know, take over all of the Americas. So you got the Mexican president AMLO saying that. And then you had Bukele, of El Salvador last July, say, let's copy the EU and Central America. Let's create a Central American Union. And then you had Rafael Correa, ex-president of Ecuador. He said, let's copy the EU for South America. You know, and then you look at Putin's Eurasian Union, it's a copy of the EU, the African Union, the Southeast Asian Union. So they're going, they're advancing with these projects. I believe the World Cup, the next World Cup is going to be held Canada, USA, Mexico. Yeah. Part of that reasoning is North American Union, because they have to integrate at the political level, economic, and cultural. And so, yeah.
That's a deep cut, actually. The World Cup as part of the, you know, Union PSYOP machine. I kind of like that. I had not considered that. I'm not a big soccer guy, but it is true. There is something to be said about the cultural significance of the World Cup. Now, I want to get your opinion on this sort of supranational union type empire. The European Union is the one we've been talking about. Is there a better example than that before the European Union? Because to me, again, like, I know that they're not giving up. I know that, you know, they, whoever they is, maybe we can get into that as well, don't seem to care about the mistakes, missteps, and landmines that they've laid out for themselves over the last 30 or so years. But they're still continuing on with this. Is that the model they're looking to first and foremost, or is there a better model from earlier in our history that maybe people are less familiar with?
There really wouldn't be. You know, I got my globalist bookshelf right up there behind me, and there's the book Governing the World by Mark Mazower. He talked in there, like, the first iteration would have been in 1815, like the Council of Europe, like after Napoleon. And it would have been like a very early version, nothing like what we see today. So you could see in history these attempts to bring Europe under control. Like, you know, we saw it before with the empires, the Roman Empire, with Napoleon and Hitler. But really the EU as we see it today, which started in, you know, late 40s, early 50s, the integration, this is like kind of the first time. And it's similar to like the UN. And yeah, here's another interesting quote. I'm shocked to hear this. George Washington, 200 years ago, said, after the Union, we got the United States of America, he says, someday we're going to have a United States of Europe. So again, I feel like a lot of these plans come from these, you know, dark occult esoteric traditions, like Freemasonry. How is it you got Thomas Jefferson and George Washington literally saying, we're going to do this, and it's happening, you know? And then you got like Manly P. Hall, one of the most famous Freemasons, you know, they're all talking about this stuff hundreds of years ago. So I think there's been this long range plan to bring about world government. And I'd say that EU is, yeah, you know, they tried League of Nations, that failed. They got UN. They're not happy with UN. They want to either reform it or create an entirely new version. Later this year, they want to create a parliament, like a UN parliamentary assembly. So it's only got like one leg, and they want to. I've been reading their white papers. They say the US and EU are the model, and they want to create a world federation. You know, and so that's why I argue that multipolarity is just one. It's like a head fake. People talk about multipolarity and BRICS. That's not an alternative. That's just. It's within the same system. So I actually think multipolarity in BRICS is going to advance us quicker towards world governments.
I think you're making a good case here. I want to talk a bit about some of the things that, even in the Bitcoin space, there's a lot of people have a hard time kind of pinning down who exactly is at the helm of these sorts of initiatives. And, you know, our mutual friend Mark has this theory that there is no they, you know, it's kind of a, just an incentives driven thing. Everyone is looking toward the same end. This is just the way the incentives work. There's other people who say that it's guys like, you know, Klaus and these other sort of walking bags of bones that seem to be immortal at some level. They never get older. They just keep looking worse and worse. And they're also meeting at Davos and WEF and the UN and things of this nature. For you, who is they? When you talk about they are driving these certain programs and initiatives for, you know, fake multipolarity or global federations, who is they for you? I'm curious.
They Live, right? They were a great movie. But massive respect for Mark Yeftovich. I love his work. And he's a similar view, I think he has to CJ Hopkins, who I've interviewed, he was just acquitted in Germany yesterday. He's not going to jail for tweeting that the German health minister was a Nazi. But, you know, I might say it both can be kind of true, but I just can't not believe, you know, given my spiritual worldview, that there is a directing force. I just can't let go of that idea. And ultimately, you know, myself as a Christian believing in the Bible, I believe there's a real entity. People use it kind of as a symbolism, but I think it's a real, like it exists, a real persona and entity, the devil, right? Satan, Lucifer. And it says that he's the prince of the power of the air. He's manipulating the nations for thousands of years now, right? And so if you have someone that's there, that's, you know, who doesn't die after, you know, one lifespan, that's there as, you know, these people are coming and going, the Klaus Schwabs and the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, but that entity is still there behind the scenes. And that, for me, that explains this continuity, right? And so I think over time, the devil has, it's kind of like waves that spiral, where he's always tried to reach that goal of world empire. And each time he's a little more successful. So he'll build up the Babylonian Empire, it'll collapse. He'll build up the Roman Empire, even bigger, it'll collapse. Then the British Empire, right, which the sun never set, which was bigger than the Roman Empire. And then that collapses. And then the American Empire, if you think about it, was bigger than the British Empire. It's got almost 1,000 bases, right, around the world. And now, you know, it's like, oh, we're almost on the cusp of a true world empire. And then some of the things that we saw during COVID, like in the Roman Empire, I was shocked to discover they actually had some sort of certificate, kind of like the certificates we were supposed to have during that time. And with these certificates, you're supposed to sacrifice to pagan gods, like sacrifice animals in the Roman Empire. If you didn't, you'd like be fined or jailed or killed. And so people would, you know, be doing fun, just buying, selling fake certificates in the Roman Empire because, you know, Christians are not going to offer sacrifice to pagan gods. And so, like, you see a lot of these same recurring, you know, under the Nazis in Germany, you had the health pass. Actually, right above me, you see the Aachen pass. I bought that during COVID on eBay from an Italian antique dealer for $10 because I was going to use it in the stores here. And that's how you can't come in because you don't have your vaccine. Here's my Nazi great. Health pass, like, to make the point, like, you guys are Nazis, you know? And so, you get my idea that it's recurring throughout history, from Rome to Middle Ages to Nazi Germany and even today. And so people talk about all these different groups. So for me, it's a moot point. It's the devil, it's Satan. And then he just uses whatever human groups he can. And there are different interests, right? People talk, there's, you know, you have the Israeli lobby. You've got the Saudi lobby. You've got the Prince Burnham, you know. There are people who obsess about Jews, and I don't do that. I mean, one core mover, the Bilderberg Group, right? People talk about. Who was one of the founders of the Bilderberg Group? Prince Bernard of the Netherlands, who was a Nazi. So, you know, how is that the Jews controlling the world? Because you've got this, you know, you've got the Nazis there, you've got Saudis, you've got the British, you've got all these different groups. And, you know, some of the people that I talk to, I think they demonstrate that all countries now have been penetrated by this global elite system. The Chinese, the Russians, they're all implementing technocracy, right? Mm-hmm. Russia's implementing the cashless system, massive facial surveillance, you know, the DNA collection, all this insanity, China, the West. So there's nobody who's not going along with this.
How do you, like, one of the problems we have in Bitcoin, I think, you know, you and I probably share this, although maybe on different topical fronts, I have such a hard time making the case for something I think is so obvious and clear with people who I otherwise view as, like, pretty intelligent, you know, pretty well informed. And maybe the worst part of all, Hrvoje, is they're people who understand that there's a problem. When you talk to the normie crowd, how do you sell this to them? How do you make the case that, like, look, what you're seeing here is the rise of this, you know, global hegemon that's going to infringe on your rights. It's going to, you know, implement different levels of technocracy. Nothing you do will not be monitored. Nothing you say will not be surveilled and policed. It's important that people know about this stuff, you know, both in terms of your interests and in terms of mine. But I have such a hard time with it. I would imagine you do too. How do you have these conversations with your sort of normie friends? Do you even have normie friends anymore? I find I have less and less, honestly. But if you have normie friends, I'd like to hear, like, you know, what's the dinner party like for you?
I do. And unfortunately, some of our friends here in Mexico, there's like a certain sub, you know, a group of category of people here in Mexico who are very normie-ish. You know, they just, we go to the typical Mexican parties, or usually kids' birthday parties, and they don't really talk about anything interesting, like real. Like, it's just very superficial stuff. And I'm like, I need to satisfy my intellect. But, you know, you had the Davos last week, the Great Reset, and I was in Morelia, Mexico, where there was the Greater Reset conference, like the anti-Davos conference. And there were Mexicans there and more foreigners. But we were discussing this with this question that you brought up. And it's, I think, you know, a lot of us went about it the wrong way in our younger years, you know, whatever topic was, 9/11, world government, Federal Reserve, we obsess about it. And then we come across as the crazy uncle, all this stuff. And then now it's just like, we go through these phases, right? Now I'm like at peace with the world. I'm happy. I'm calm. Every day I go out in the sun and, you know, people, you know, have this idea that we are like depressed and freaking out every day. No. And so I think we have to get that across. We have to like show that we're happy. And then when we talk to people, we always have to have empathy, love, be open, listening to them. And I think that often means not bringing this stuff up, you know, waiting for a way, maybe they'll bring it up first, or bringing it up, you know, in a certain way, that's not, you know, overbearing, because otherwise, you know, you're not going to progress. They're going to think you're crazy. And, you know, one way that I think if we're successful in what we're doing as well, if we can show that we're happy and we're successful, like I post clips on my social media of TT and geopolitics and me hanging out with a lot of these figures in alternative media. And I think if some of my normie friends look at that and say, oh, he's not really that crazy guy I thought he was, you know, he's hanging out with all these people, he's got this show, a lot of the things he's talking about is coming to pass, maybe I'm gonna go hang out with this again. That's kind of my approach, you know, establishing credibility and giving off a good vibe. Yeah, I don't know,
the receipts are important and the vibes are important. I've taken some shit on our show for talking about the vibes, but there is something to be said about the vibes. I don't know exactly what, but I think they are important when you're talking to your friends and family. I want to talk to you about the sort of relevance at the moment of the nation state. And I want to bring this up because obviously there's I hate to use the phrase, but, you know, one of the most important elections in recent memory in the United States coming up this year. And I think I've heard guys like Martin Armstrong and others talk about how this is an important year for democracies everywhere. Something like 50 or 60% of all what we would consider to be modern democratic nations are voting for leadership at some level this coming year. Is there anything that the voters can do to change this? It's a topic we tackle from time to time, this sort of the relevance of an engaged electorate. And this was something that a lot of nations have in the past really planted their flag on as a sign that they were a successful democracy, that they have an engaged electorate, an informed, whatever that means, quote unquote, informed electorate. And there's not, you know, so much apathy when it comes time to cast ballots. Now, apathy has been increasing all over the place. And I fear that it's because most people are not only losing interest, but understand that no matter what they do, there's too much inertia to a clearly established endpoint, and they just don't care. Is that really the case for modern nations? What role do things like elections and maybe at a higher level, the modern nation state have for the average person? Should people care at all about this stuff? Should they be voting? What should they be doing if not?
I had a great chat on TNT with on Monday with Tim Moen, who was Canadian firefighter, paramedic, who ran as Libertarian candidate's president in Canada, 2015, I think. You probably have him on if you haven't, but he touched a little bit on this. For example, the Canadians are fed up, but he begged the question, what can we do? Can we sustain the resistance like in Canada? But yeah, and I don't want to tell people what to do in this regard. Like, if people want to go vote, they want to run for local office, do it. Go and do it if you've got that drive. You know, here in Mexico, unfortunately, the first week of January in Mexico, three political candidates, some of them were maybe for like mayor or state something, were assassinated. Three
oh boy.
Political candidates in the first week of the year in Mexico were assassinated. You know, in Ecuador last year, two within like the span of a week or two. So if people are driven to do it, to vote, to get active, do it.
Yeah,
I'm definitely not going to say don't do it. Just my personal view is after COVID, it's lost complete interest in this. Because I'm a citizen of three countries, right? U.S., Croatia, Mexico. I follow what's going on there. You know, I think up until 2020, I thought, you know, maybe, you know, there was this interesting politician here in Mexico, that one in Croatia, you know, Thomas Massey's, Rand Paul's in the U.S. And then when COVID happened, they implemented a scientific dictatorship, a technocracy. And it's just like all the countries did the same thing. And it's just like, there's no more democracy. I've had on someone I greatly respect on both my shows, Gregory Copley. He's an elderly dude of International Strategic Studies Association. And years ago, he was telling me in my program, the era of democracy is over. It's finished. No more democracy. We're now in an age of tyranny, authoritarianism. Democracy may return at some point, but right now we're in an age of tyranny, authoritarianism in the West, in the East, everywhere. And so that's kind of how I feel. And so Friday, so a few days ago was the last day for me, the deadline. I just learned that same day for me to get my Mexican voter ID, which I hate paperwork. I haven't gotten it. So I can't vote this year in the Mexican election cycle. It's like, I don't really care, you know, because I feel like the globalist system, the infrastructure that they have in place in all countries around the world is there. Here in Mexico, I've seen it. I live in a resilient city, which is a smart city, here in Guadalajara, Mexico. I was trying to discover this 3 years ago. And they're building out public transport because they want to take away our cars. They're pushing the cashless system. And then you look the mechanisms, how that's working here. You've got these foreign NGOs, UN consulting companies, the McKinsey's, the Rockefeller Foundation is actually financing. I got the official government papers that says the Rockefeller Foundation finances the resilient city where I live to build out all this infrastructure. So when you think about voting, it's like our mayors, our governors, they're all captured. So again, if someone, I think you can make changes that way, and so you should. But I just personally, I'm just kind of like throwing my hands up here.
talk to me about the technocracy. One of the things that I want to talk to you about was the sort of algo ghetto and the idea that, in my opinion, the thing you need the most to be a sovereign citizen is free. There's a better way to describe this, but let's call it unburdened currency flow. Being able to spend your money on anything that you see fit and being able to receive money for services you provide, even if they are not, you know, particularly palatable for the government of the day. My big concern, obviously, as a Bitcoin guy, is that I'm looking across the landscape here in a place like Canada where a lot of this stuff flies under the radar, honestly, here, way. Like, no one talks about this stuff. If you try and tell somebody that the reason electric cars are becoming, you know, more prevalent in media and, you know, programs are showing up to subsidize the purchase of electric vehicles, it's not to save the environment, but rather to make sure that you can't charge the car if you've done something that, you know, is unpalatable, I'll use the term again, for the government of the day. It's a difficult conversation to have. But I think that people understand how important it is that their money works. No matter how old, how young, how technologically savvy, how interested in things like Bitcoin and free currencies you are, everyone knows that if you get a roof done, paying in cash, the ability to pay in cash is important for a number of reasons I won't get into here, but it seems to me that more and more people are willing to kind of at least entertain that money is the wedge into a lot of these things. Are you finding the same thing? And I want to hear a bit more about this resilient city, the smart city, because we've talked about this on the show as well. There's a couple of Canadian examples of cities that have thought about piloting this publicly. I don't know of any that actually went through with it, but I'm curious to hear what your experiences have been like in a city like that as well.
So, I mean, you're right with what you said. And again, at the Greater Reset conference last week, the Greater Reset.org, Derek Rose, John Bush, they're solutions focused. So there's a lot of crypto folks, tech solutions, health solutions. And I mean, you guys are more well-versed on that than I am when it comes to the financial and crypto and all that stuff. But I think that's key. And I've been trying to extrapolate from where we are and into the, because, you know, I had a 2021, I was banned from Patreon. 2022, the Department of Homeland Security banned me from PayPal.
That's an insane story. Absolutely insane.
And it's that, you know, it's, I didn't lose any money, but it's just like the fact that me, a US citizen, the law abiding, nonviolent, peaceful dude, just having intellectual conversations, that gets me under the radar of the Department of Homeland Security, the American Stasi. And then they tell, this is political persecution. This is why PayPal, I tell them, it says I'm a risk. And that was, you know, when they rolled out the Disinformation Governance Board in April 2022. So Mint Press, Consortium News, and me, a band. You know, Kim Iverson covered my story, and Matt Taibbi. And so that's where we are. And so, yeah, we need the financial freedom. And so they're going to be cutting that stuff off. So we kind of have to figure out how can we still operate, you know. There are solutions, but I don't know how long-term they are. Like, people talk about gold and silver. It's like, okay, I might have some gold and silver, but if I'm shut off, I mean, there might come a point where I will end up using all of my gold and silver coins, and then what? You know? Yeah. Or you'll have food. You know, that's why, at least if you have food and water, you can continue surviving. But you might run out of gold and silver. The crypto stuff, that's a different story. You know, if people talk about Monero and some of the more other private coins. But the algorithm ghetto, that's another thing. So one of my favorite interviews was 2020. So this is early on into what happened in 2020. In May, yeah. I contact Edwin Black, the renowned, I have huge respect for him, the renowned Jewish historian. He's written the books, many of them I got there. They're like this thick on IBM and the Holocaust, right? How IBM created the computer for Hitler to classify all of the citizens so that they can figure out who they wanted to go after, Jude, right? Or other undesirables. And so he calls it the algorithm ghetto. So he compares it, Jewish historian Edwin Black says, you know, you had the Jewish physical ghetto where Jews are physically walled in. And now they're creating for all of us globally the algorithm ghetto. So we're going to be put in this digital concentration camp or digital ghetto. And if you don't do whatever the regime says, they just shut you off. And you can envision, he was giving an example. Imagine your local food mart. And if there's no cash, you won't even be able to buy milk at your local shop or bread because there's no cash. And if you did something wrong, your payment won't work. And no one's going to want to help you because the same thing's going to happen to them. So what's the point of them even trying to help you? Because we're all under this surveillance, and now it's a neo-feudalism. So this project, this algorithm ghetto, this Great Reset project, it's neo-feudalism. They want to bring us back 1,000 years, get rid of the middle class. We see that happening everywhere now. Inflation is eroding the middle class. Housing, I think it's by design. Everywhere I go, I talk that you can't afford a place to buy
yeah,
anymore, whether it's Canada, USA, Mexico, Croatia. And I think it's all by design. So they want to create just the two classes, the 99, the aristocracy, and us serfs and plebs. And then they're taking away our cars. You know, in Nuevo León state, the governor, Samuel Garcia, hardcore globalist. He went to Davos, took photos with Klaus Schwab, invited him back to Nuevo León. Tesla is building his factories in Nuevo León. And this guy, Samuel Garcia, he said things like a few years ago. He said, if you make fun of me on social media, straight to jail. Literally. 36 hours jail and a fine. There was pushback, and he said, okay, just kidding. And then he even said, he literally said, we want to get this, I think, 6 million people, 3 million cars in Nuevo León, that he wants to get rid of cars, private vehicles in Nuevo León. So, they want to get rid of the cars. That's why they're building out insanely the public transport where I live in Guadalajara, because they want to get rid of the cars. They're going to say, look at all the public transport. You don't need a car. And then vehicle emissions. Last year was the first year in Mexico where they forced you to do the vehicle emissions test. Before that, you didn't have to do it. One of my friends just now said her car, 2002, did not pass the vehicle emissions. It's illegal. So they just made her car illegal. She cannot drive it. She's like, I don't know what to do. I'm going to sell it and then buy another newer car that will allow me to pass the emissions. So you see how they're all these different ways they're going to make owning a vehicle too expensive, either with the annual tax, the vehicle emissions checks will say, oh, this, your car is illegal. All of a sudden, in Canada, they said by 2035, no new gas powered cars will be sold.
Yeah.
Ireland is the same, Japan, many other countries. And so, and in these white papers of the resilient city, they talk about cashless. So they want to get rid of cash. In our banking apps, so this started 2 or 3 years ago in Mexico, you cannot log onto your bank account through your computer or phone unless you turn on geolocation, so they know where you are. And if you don't have geolocation, now you can access your money. And now they keep pushing every time you log in the contactless payment system. It was called CODI, the Central Bank of Mexico. And because everyone uses cash and they don't want to use the cashless payment system, CODI, they try it again, and now it's called DIMI. And they keep pushing. And this is coming from the globalists who are coming through the Mexican Central Bank. They want to get Mexicans to start using the contactless stuff. And it's like, no, I'm not activating that. You know, no. So you see they're pushing cashless. They're pushing the to take away our transport. In Minority Report, they're building out the internet infrastructure. And it says even in the white papers that it alludes to pre-crime type stuff, you know. And
really?
It's just going to keep going in this direction. You see it everywhere. I mean, I follow biometricupdate.com among many other resources. And today, I'll rewrite the headline in my head. It said, Eastern Caribbean countries mull regional biometric ID to facilitate free movements. Let me translate that. 11 Caribbean countries plan diabolical biometric digital ID system to limit free movement. And so this is going on in every country now behind the scenes. And I think this crisis, you know, we're on the precipice of something, financial crisis. You know, the ECB was just announced this morning. ECB is telling, where is it here? It says, asks lenders to monitor social media for early signs of bank runs.
I did see that.
There's going to be a new crisis that's going to then push us into this new system. The algorithm ghetto that they're creating for us.
The algorithm ghetto, I think, you know, when I frame this to people like my father or other people who are sort of a little longer in the tooth than you or I always say the same thing to start. And it's really centered around capital flight. If you can ignore all the sort of globalist WEF, cashless this, cashless that, you know, you could not ever mention terms like algorithm ghetto that might turn off a normie. But as soon as you start talking to people about framing all these policy decisions through the lens of preventing capital flight, there's an immediate red light that goes off. And if you look at places like China, they've done this for a long time. They monitor your social media. They can say, and you know, the European Union and Canadian government and your American government can say whatever they want about the reasons. You know, there's hate speech, which is sort of this fake, vacuous, nebulous term that doesn't mean anything until it does, and they shut down your bank account. They could talk about, as you mentioned, making sure there's no bank runs coming. Well, bank runs don't happen when you have the money or Voyer. It doesn't really make a difference if you're running a competent, well-backed financial system. Of course, none of these nations are. And so I think capital flight is a good way to frame this stuff for people. I've used that in the past. I would recommend people think about that as well. Because when it comes down to it, what you want to be able to do at the very least is, if a country goes sideways on you, whether it's your home nation or a nation you've made your home over the course of 10 or 12 years, you want to be able to leave with the money and the value and the wealth you've created and not have to leave with empty pockets or diamonds stitched to your pocket lining, right? To make another callback. We're losing that capability in a lot of ways. I think Bitcoin can help with this, but I think at the end of the day, there's going to be regulations and, you know, attempts to criminalize that as well. We've seen that in the US. I don't know if you've kept up with this at all, but in the United States, we've seen people like Low IQ Liz Warren talking about criminalizing and adding reporting burdens to what she calls self-hosted wallets, basically any Bitcoin wallet that's not exchange held. So you might have a Bitcoin wallet, a 12 word in your head. You're shaking your head. I know, it's crazy, isn't it? This idea that self-hosted wallets are lending themselves to criminal activity, when anyone with two brain cells to rub together can point to the fact that almost all global criminal activity that could be classified as revolving around money, money transmission is done with the US dollar. But this is where they're planting their flag, right? It's alarming to me that this is, you know, this is becoming part of a broader problem. I want to just double click on one thing you said there about the cashless society. Are you concerned about the demographic shift in a lot of these countries that young people are sort of not only willing, but prefer cashless, contactless cell phone payments here? Is that a problem? Like, are we at some point fighting an uphill battle talking about, you know, we need to keep using cash, we need to stay away from this contactless stuff, don't turn on your geolocation, don't do this, don't do that, when every single app, you know, will let you geotag a photo with a fancy bubble letter, you know, banner, and every single grocery store and retailer will let you tap wirelessly with the retailer's app to get a little discount or a little benefit. How can we get through to young people on this? You and I have been around long enough, and I'm pretty young. Like, I'm only 36. I know how far things have come in the last 3 years, but if I stretch it out to 15, the transformation is almost unbelievable to look back on. How do we convince these young people who are 15, 16, 17 now, that what they're doing here is contributing to a broader problem that there will be no coming back from if we don't try and get ahead of it now?
I think you hit on the key there, and I've heard other people, what you just brought up, mention as well, that this is the issue. That this is the core. This is the elite's strategy, where you just outlined the youth, and this is the principal issue. I think Jeremy Ryan Slate, who I had recently on my podcast, and someone else, I think it may be Jacob Nordengard or Gary Robinson. He's this Polish, he's a British guy in Poland, an academic who focuses on technocracy, and what he just... months ago, what you told me is exactly what you said now. But before getting to that, I've had out my podcast, like Casey, International Man, right? All about internationalization, all about, yep, you know, planting your different flags. I got my, my three passports, right? US, Mexico, Croatia. I've got a bank. I don't have any accounts in the US because I'm just done with the US. But, you know, Mexico, still got a bank account in Kazakhstan. In Croatia, so it's important. Like, I've got places to go. I can always kind of like disappear. There's places I can go, you know, land or staying with people. And so it's good to have those options. But I think, and I have them just in case. And you know, I'm hoping that I can find whatever, you know, funds I have here, I can send to Croatia if I have to escape or whatever. But I think going forward, it's going to be much more difficult. You know, what do you do? This year, Europe is implementing Etias. So if you're not a European citizen, it's a social credit system. You got to pay 10 euros and fill out this form and wait to be approved. And they're basically checking your social credit status. And if you said something you didn't like, so bad, you can't go to Europe. You can't go to Paris, Rome, Croatia. I can't be the EU citizen still, but I did a great interview with Todd Miller, who's a leftist, but he explains how, and he's following what he called the border security complex, that they are scaffolding this. So the US has offices all over the world, in America, Middle East, Asia, and they're helping those countries to build out the same sort of US TSA control system. That's what Europe did. So Europe just copied the US model and then other countries. So all countries will eventually strictly control who can exit and enter. Their own citizens as well as others. And then getting to the youth, you know, during COVID, my last year, I was teaching virtually from here to Kazakhstan the last year, 2020, 2021. So it's like, you know, Sunday evenings here, Monday mornings, Kazakhstan, you know, the whole online Zoom thing, which sucked, Microsoft Teams or whatever. But I was asking these kids at that time in Kazakhstan, you couldn't go to the coffee shop, the restaurant, or the malls in Kazakhstan. They were very strict there. Without having they had the Ashuk app, I think it was called, and you had to have the green status. So if you were PCR tested up, and I've never taken one of those things, I will never take that, or vaxxed up, you would get the green status, which will allow you to buy coffee in Kazakhstan, go to the supermarket. And if, you know, most people complied. I'm asking these young students, the teenagers that I was teaching, I'm like, so what do you think about that? Like, is that okay? And they were all like, yeah, it's fine. It's cool. It's normal. It's like,
holy shit.
And I'm like, I couldn't, like, do you understand this? And you're living in the former Soviet Union. Kazakhstan was part of the Soviet Union, you know? I still have Kazakhs to this day who would tell me, shh, let's not talk about politics. You know, they would tell me, like, they're still afraid. They would say, don't talk about politics. They would tell this to me. So I mean, the church that I attended in Kazakhstan was a century old, and they told me that their sister church during the Soviet Union, you'd have the government come in and all the men at one point disappeared and never came back, you know, or they would destroy the church. The church was rebuilt. Then the government would come back again and confiscate the land. I mean, this was life under the totalitarian Soviet Union. So these kids today, they don't know anything about history. Like, you know, I told them, like, hey, I took hands with Mikhail Gorbachev, the last, your last president of the Soviet Union. And they're like, who's Mikhail Gorbachev?
Did they ask you for his Instagram handle? What's his Instagram handle?
I think he died a few years ago. It was the last year, 2 years ago. But this is the problem. And this is the elite's strategy now, is they're focusing on the youth. If they can get enough buy-in from the youth, then we're screwed, Joy. I don't know what to tell you.
I look forward to the eventual algorithm ghetto. Maybe I'll see you in there. I want to just ask you one more question. Your views on Bitcoin, Roy, you're describing a lot of problems here that a lot of my listeners will say that, you know, these guys are going to be hammering away in the comments on Twitter, on the live stream chat. They're going to be saying Bitcoin is a fix for a lot of these things. Do you have a view on Bitcoin? You mentioned Monero. There's some other sort of tokens that are out there that are, you know, in my opinion, inferior. But I'm curious, like, you must have given this some thought at some point. Where do you come down on something like Bitcoin?
Well, like I said, that's not the whole Bitcoin crypto space is not. I'm like Dave Portnoy. So I've got a video of his recently. And he's like, he bought Bitcoin and then he thought it was safe with saving cash and then he lost it. And it's like, that's me. I don't know how to do that technical stuff. And because I've already got DHS breathing down my neck and NATO, because they co-wrote the article for Associated Press, which mentioned me. And then like a week later, I was off of Patreon. I don't mess around with the crypto. Like, I actually paid an accountant a few years ago, once I started getting some donations in crypto, to report, right? And I don't understand. There's people that I meet that are U.S. citizens, specifically U.S. citizens, because for other countries, like for Mexico, they don't care as a Mexican citizen. But, you know, you got to report to the IRS no matter where you live as an American, which I do. And so I don't want to mess around. And so that's one of the main reasons why I don't get further into crypto, because I want to report everything. And then that just makes it much more cumbersome for me to use crypto. But for the rest of y'all, knock yourselves out. But yeah, I mean, I think I listen to Max Keiser, I listen to everyone, Mark Yeftovich, a lot of smart people. And I do think Bitcoin has value. I do kind of more agree with Keiser's view that, like, if you're going to use any crypto, use Bitcoin, right? Generally, everything else are poo-poo coins. But I also think there is value to stuff like Monero. A lot of people in the privacy space that I talk to, the alt media, you know, Gabriel Custodian, the Watchmen Privacy, the Greater Reset people, you know, Monero are more private coins. But the system, I think that if they can co-opt it, you know, they're going to make, you saw what they announced from the 1st of January this year because of the Inflation Reduction Act. I mean, this was nuts. Like, they're saying now in the U.S. that if you get to 10,000 or more in crypto, you will have to report the sender, like your social security number. I mean, what if it's a foreigner? They don't have social security. You can't even know they're sent. You don't know who's sending you the crypto. You have to report in 15 days or it's a felony. Like, what? Like this, you can't even comply with this stuff. And so they're going to try to make, you know, attack anything that's alternative to CBDC. You know, before that, I've had the view that, you know, baby Bitcoin was a globalist Trojan horse. I don't know. My theory was that the elites put it out there as a way to whet our appetites, you know, let people get rich through Bitcoin and Ethereum in the initial, you know, 2010s. And that kind of like builds the bridge towards CBDCs. But I don't talk about that so much anymore because I don't know. And, you know, maybe it is becoming a moot point because of all the other things that they're doing, you know, attacking the exchanges, bringing these cumbersome tax issues, what you, Elizabeth Warren, what you mentioned, you know, so they will try to co-opt Bitcoin, or maybe there are different ways, you know, better that they can, you know, if they buy more Bitcoins, they can control the market for Bitcoin. I don't know.
We got to get you on the Bitcoin. We got to figure this out. I'm going to tell Mark to send you some resources here because you're too smart. You got too big an audience to be leaning anywhere but into Bitcoin as part of the solution. I don't think it's the whole solution. I think there's like something to be said about communities and learning skills that are important. And I've heard you talk actually recently on your show about stuff like trades. You know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you
said on your program that if you go back to when you were like 18, 19, you would think now about doing trade school instead of going through, you know, I think a lot of people are like that. I'm like that as well. And I think that all these things matter. And there's sort of a bigger set of solutions that we could look to fix some of these problems long-term. But anyway, it's a conversation for another time. Pervoy, you've been a great guest. I want to give you a chance to tell people where they can find you, any resources you want to point to. The floor is all yours, brother.
geopoliticsandempire.com. It's funny, if you type that into the Google search engine, nothing appears. Blacklisted, crazy. TNTradio.live. I've got my 2-hour show, 6 to 8 p.m., 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 to 8 p.m. Central, live in video transmission now, Monday through Friday. So people can call in, talk to my guests during the TNT show. So TNTRadio.live, geopoliticsandempire.com. There's my Substack. I'm very active on my Twitter and Telegram. There's, I think, 13,000 subscribers on
the Telegram channel. Is so good. I'm in the Telegram channel. It's very, very good. Very active.
Yeah, I'm curating like the news that I find most interesting every day. I'm just posting it there along with my video clips. And so, yeah, and you like the work that you guys are doing. It's awesome as well.
Appreciate that. Thanks everyone for listening, tuning in. We'll talk to you next time. Well done. That was